So, to summarize the steps of in vitro fertilization, there are many steps that occur over an eight or nine day period. You've got to mature the oocytes, and you've got to put the sperm and eggs together, then you've got to culture them, and then you've got to do something with it and so on. It requires precise timing, both on the farm when you're doing the hormone injections and aspirations and so on. It requires lab facilities. If you're aspirating on the farm, then one ships the oocytes typically in an incubator, Federal Express, overnight to a laboratory, and then ship the embryos back. And all of this makes it expensive per calf produced. And again, Dr. Hinshaw will go into some of this stuff in a bit more detail. Now, to give you a little feel for how well this works, if we take a cow, we can maybe typically get 10 good oocytes from the transvaginal aspiration. We'll get about 8 of those fertilized, 3 or 4 blastocysts. We'll get 1-2 pregnancies on the average. These pregnancies are not quite as healthy as pregnancies from routine reproductive practices. And there can be some problems with oversized calves and so on, much less than in previous times, but there's mainly an increased rate of abortion. Rather than having something like 6 or 7% loss from a 30-day pregnancy rate, it might be 10 or 15%. So, We don't get a lot of pregnancy and a lot of calves on the average per try. But so what are the attractions of this technology? One, you can get lots of oocytes from slaughterhouses. They're cheap, plentiful, and that's great for us researchers who don't get very good funding, and so we can get lots of material cheaply and do experiments. One can collect the oocytes in vivo frequently, so it depends a little bit on the technique you use, but in fact, you can go into a cow every 4 days and aspirate oocytes. And so if you only get a calf every time, that's 2 calves a week for as long as you're aspirating. And some cows work a lot better than that, some work a lot poorer, but in the average, you can go in that frequently. Now, for practical purposes, one typically does that weekly or every 2 weeks, and it depends if you're doing the FSH treatment or not, and all kinds of things. So there are a number of unique applications. One is dead cows, and in fact, we've done this with cows and horses that have been dead for a half a day or even longer. Take the ovaries out, and we can get some offspring. As in the human situation, can be used for circumvent infertility. And it fits sex semen in a unique way. And again, Dr. Hinshaw will go into that a bit more detail, but let me just prime you for that. Sex semen isn't available from the majority of bulls. Okay? But you can take a straw of sex semen a frozen semen, and sex any straw you want, just one straw at a time. You don't get very many sperm. You don't get enough to do AI, but you get enough to do lots of in vitro fertilization. And that's being done a lot now with dairy cows, where you can take any bull you want. And the important point is you thaw it, you sex it, and you use it. You don't refreeze it. You use it then. And because the sexing process cleans up the sperm, gets rid of the dead sperm, it's one of the fringe benefits of sexing semen, that semen is really good quality. So most of the sex semen we got isn't good quality because you freeze it after sexing and you kill half the sperm. In this case, you've gotten rid of all those dead sperm. So it works very nicely. So, but the bottom line for most of us for the current situation is to amplify female reproduction. Conventional superovulation embryo transfer is usually simpler and less expensive than in vitro fertilization. Now, that may change and likely will, but for the moment, That's what the bottom line is on that. Now, there are special situations, and one of those is in vitro fertilization in Brazil. So in Brazil, they do about 500,000 in vitro fertilizations every year, 500,000 eggs, 500,000 embryos. And there were three big advantages. One, the Bos indicus cows give twice as many oocytes as the Bos taurus cows when you do anything, transvaginal aspiration from FSH-treated, non-treated, or whatever. You get lots more eggs. And in fact, there are some of those cows, they've gotten 400 embryos from one aspiration, believe it or not. That's rare, but I'm saying on the average, it's much different from Bos taurus. They've got lots of cheap labor and inexpensive recipients. And in vitro fertilization has really taken off under those circumstances. Okay, so that's the first of the three technologies that are more futuristic I want to talk about. The second one is cloning. So with cloning, the genetic parent is a diploid somatic cell. Whereas with normal reproduction, we have two parents. We have the sperm and the egg. And the way this works is we take our We take our somatic cell and we basically fertilize the egg with that cell rather than with a sperm. We talk about nuclear transplantation. It's really not nuclear transplantation. It's really fusion of this small cell with a big oocyte. Typically, the oocyte volume is 5,000 times that of this cell, so you get a little bit of cytoplasm in there. You've got to get rid of the DNA in the oocyte, and that's typically done by just aspirating it, but there are a number of things. You can zap it with a laser and so on, but you've got to destroy that material. And so instead of getting half the genetic material from the egg, half from the sperm, you get a double dose from the somatic cell. The fertilization is done by an electrical shock, and one gets a fusion there instead of what normally happens with sperm. A second thing you need to do is turn the egg on. So when a sperm fertilizes an egg, it does two things. It adds the genetic material, but it turns the egg on to start developing. The oocyte, as was pointed out earlier yesterday, is a slowly dying cell. After 8 or 10 hours, it's degenerating. The only thing that'll get an oocyte from dying to developing is being turned on by the sperm. The sperm does that with a special enzyme called phospholipase C-zeta. And when we're cloning, we don't have that situation, and so we've got to do something to turn the egg on, basically increase the calcium concentration in the oocyte, and there are a number of tricks to do that. Typically, one does that with a second electrical shock that's a little different. Sex is a getting a charge out of things, you know. You've got to turn the system on. Okay. There are a lot of similarities between cloning and in vitro fertilization. We've got to have a factory, an oocyte, so we've got to do oocyte maturation. We do the fertilization the way I just described, and we've got to culture the embryo. So we have the same problems as with in vitro fertilization. There are the differences that we also have to take the chromosomes out of the oocyte. We have got to turn the oocyte on. We've got to keep the donor cells healthy, these somatic cells. The success rates are quite low, and it's an expensive proposition. So, of course, the first animal-produced cloning via somatic cells was Dolly. Actually, the second author on that paper, Dolly, Angela Gashnika, worked in our laboratory for 3 years before going to Scotland to help clone Dolly. So we have a kind of connection there. And she sent me a Christmas card with Dolly, which is why I've got that. And by the way, Dolly was one success out of 273 tries. So it didn't work so well. But currently it works a little bit better than that. So typically one fuses 100 oocytes with somatic cells. About 60 of those would develop to the two-cell stage. About 15 would produce blastocysts. Now all this happens in vitro, so you just need to transfer the 15 blastocysts. You probably get three pregnancies. Half of them will abort. And then a lot of the calves will have problems, but you end up with a healthy calf from 100 oocytes. Now, they say that's pretty discouraging. On the other hand, it's not so difficult to fuse, 300, 400 oocytes in an afternoon. So one can get through the thing with lots of volume. What kinds of somatic cells can you use? What kinds of embryonic cells? So the first cloning work was done with actually embryo cells, blastomeres from an eight-cell embryo, cells from the inner cell mass, primordial germ cells. Dolly came from a mammary cell line. But I don't know if I should tell you why. Does anybody know the etymology of Dolly? Why did they call her Dolly? Mammary tissue and Dolly Parton. Those came together. This is a true story. Okay. But you can also clone from white blood cells, muscle, oviduct epithelium. The cumulus cells around the oocyte work great, fibroblasts, and so on. Okay. Now, how faithful a copy do you get when you're cloning by these methods? So we are what we are, our phenotype, because of a number of things. One is our genetics, one is our environment, and another set of things called epigenetics. When we're cloning, we copy the chromosomal parts of the system. We don't even get the same mitochondrial genes. And the mitochondrial genes are a very small percentage of the genes, much less than 1%. But the mitochondria are very important. And again, those come from the egg, not from the donor cell. And then there are epigenetic things that I'll not go into, but they also affect our phenotype. And then there are, of course, the environmental things. So when you clone, you've got to do embryo transfer. So the uterus is going to be different from the original animal you were cloning from. So the environment's already different. And, of course, postnatal environment will be different. So all these aspects are under much less control when you're cloning than this one. And the bottom line from all that is clones are not identical with the original. They're not even quite genetically identical. So when we're copying really outstanding phenotypic animals, we're often going to be disappointed because the reason this cow is really a great cow, or bull is a really great bull, is partly due to the genetics, but partly due to all these other things, environmental things and so on. And of course, the environment will change and so on, epigenetic effects. So the clone copy will not be identical with the original, and clone mates will not be identical with each other. And we see that in code color patterns and all kinds of things. So let me illustrate that a little bit differently by talking about horses. So if you clone horses that win races, you're likely going to be disappointed in the performance of the clones. Because the reason that horse won the race is partly genetics, but partly environment, epigenetics, all kinds of chance sorts of things. Now, on the other hand, let's say you've got a stallion who sires race winners. You clone him, you're going to get a stallion that sires race winners, because that's a genetic thing, not a phenotypic thing. And so we need to think about that same thing when we're thinking about cloning cattle. So if we're cloning a bull that sires great offspring, you're going to get a copy that sires great offspring. If you get a bull that wins the show, you might not be so satisfied because that's a phenotypic thing. Identical twins, triplets, and so on are natural clones. So the methods we're using to clone will make less identical animals than identical twins are with each other. So identical twins is the gold standard. We know that identical twins differ from each other. Clones will differ from each other more than identical twins. So there's also a problem with messing with nature to the extent we're doing that with cloning, because we're taking this donor cell, let's say it was designed to be a mammary tissue cell, and we're saying now it's supposed to make an organism, okay? It's being given a completely different job. And we don't reprogram those things perfectly every time, and that's why we get low percentage going to blastocysts, lots of abortions and that kind of thing. But nuclear transplant calves at birth, most are morphologically normal, most are slow to nurse, they're metabolically abnormal, their insulin's way off the chart, their glucose is low typically, high incidence of neonatal death, 20 to 30% are oversized, there's some increase in genetic congenital abnormalities. Now most of these problems are temporary, and they're due to basically having a fairly normal fetus and an abnormal placenta. So when we clone, it's the outer cells of the embryo that we screw up and make an abnormal placenta. And so if you take really good care of that calf at birth, they normalize in a couple days in 90% of the cases. And then they're, for practical purposes, normal. Okay, but you've got to get them out of this abnormal placenta situation. Now, these things are improving a lot versus 10 or 12 years ago, but one still sees those things. And just to illustrate that, here's some data from some clonal sets we had at Colorado State University. These happen to be male Brangus calves, and this is a set of three clones. Here we have a 144-pound calf. Okay, you don't see 144-pound Brangus calves normally, okay? Here's another set that were overweight as well. Now, as I say, with current technology, it's maybe 20, 30% of these calves are overweight. They normalize once you get them out of this abnormal placental environment. So there are great possibilities with cloning, however. One, you can reproduce castrates. So you can make a steer into a bull. It's been used already to reproduce mules, copy genotypes. An example was mentioned last evening on what do you do with the F1 Angus Nalori cross animals, because you breed them to Angus, you breed them to Nalori in Brazil. Well, one thing you do is clone them. The F1s are really great, but they don't breed true, okay? So that would be an example of something you might do. Another obvious one is insurance for valuable bulls. And that's being done by some of the bull studs. You just make a copy. And as I say, from a genetic standpoint, that really makes great sense. So there are some insurance companies that rather than pay $100,000 insurance on the bull, we'll just make you a copy. So what are the costs of cloning? So it depends on success and all kinds of things, but typically for cloning cattle these days, it's $15,000 to $20,000 per clone that you get. So way too expensive to think about eating those things and so on. Although FDA has determined that clones are as safe to eat as anything else, so they're approved for human consumption. The industry, however, has taken the tack that it's best not to raise that controversy, and cloned cattle typically do not go into the food chain, nor milk from cloned cattle. Progeny of them are okay. Okay, the final technology I want to talk about is transgenics. So transgenic technology is a deliberate change in the DNA sequence that is transmitted to offspring. Another term that's used in the context of plants is genetically modified organisms. And with transgenesis, you basically can do things. You can add genes, you can delete genes, or you can correct genes. So we talk about curly calf syndrome. Yeah, we just do transgene, you could fix it. So just to illustrate that, so here we have a chromosome, and with a transgenic manipulation, we could add it and make it longer, so we could add this thing to it. Another manipulation is we take this, remove it, and we have this chromosome. So that just illustrates the things you can do with transgenesis. We use micromanipulators to do these things. The same thing we use for sperm injection by fertilization by brute force. So this just illustrates a one-cell embryo being fixed by suction on a pipette here. And here's another pipette where we inject the DNA or some construct, some system to change the genetics in this one-cell embryo. So if you make the change to the one-cell embryo, when it copies its genetic material to go to two-cell embryo, it copies the change. And so you get in every cell in the body of that resulting individual. So that's the ideal way to make transgenic animals, change it at the one-cell stage. And so this is ancient history, but this is an example of a normal mouse, another mouse that was changed so that the growth hormone was regulated differently, so there's more growth hormone produced, and so this mouse grew faster. A study we did along those lines at Colorado State University is to cross a chicken with a cow. So we've got a gene from a chicken called C-Ski. This is a gene that causes extra muscle fiber growth in birds. So we put that into a bovine embryo. And we ended up with an animal that has much more muscle fiber than the control. So we can do those sorts of things. You can do all kinds of razzle-dazzle things. One of my favorites is in cattle to put the growth genes on the Y chromosome. So we're going to put the terminal cross genes on the Y chromosome. So the males will be terminal cross. The females will be maternal. You just use sex semen. You can get whatever ratio you want. Okay? Just as an example of a transgenic trick that you might use. Now, of course, you want those growth genes to be expressed after birth, so you still want to have small calves, but you can arrange that as well, just the way things are regulated. So, transgenic applications. Actually, the Dolly experiments were done to develop better methods of making transgenic animals. So what you do is you take the somatic cells of the animal you want to change, and you modify those in vitro. So you do all your genetic manipulations in petri dishes and test tubes and so on. And once you got the changes in there you want, you clone it and make the animal. Okay, rather than making all kinds of animals, see which one works and so on, you do all that stuff in vitro. And it turns out that the people who do these transgenic manipulations typically use cloning as the last step to make the animal. So, we have the almost ideal bull, but he's got horns instead of polled. We grow some cells in vitro, change a gene or two, and we make the perfect bull. So, there's a lot of argument about genetically modified organisms and so on. And, you know, in North America at the moment, 90% of our corn's genetically modified, 90% of soybeans, 80% of papaya, 0% of food animals. There is one transgenic salmon that now is sort of approved for human consumption. That's working its way through the systems. So typically, if we want to get pulled trait into a population, we do it by introgressions. We make half blood, three quarters, seven eighths, and so on. So we can do that with one step and do exactly the same thing. So should we consider that a genetically modified organism because we use a different technique to do it? But all we've done is, instead of replacing it by introgression, we just replaced it, or we just fixed it, okay? So we need to get our thinking straight on those sorts of things. So transgenic animal agriculture will eventually be very important. Currently, it's a very expensive business. There are legitimate food safety concerns. There are illegitimate food safety concerns. I'd say when we make a polled animal by making exactly the same way to get introgression, we haven't done anything unsafe. We just used our heads. Okay, and these things are justified in research, so I think it's something that 20 years from now, we won't worry about it nearly as much. So I always take the example, let's say we try to get vaccination approved today. So what are we going to do? We're going to take pathogenic organisms, grind them up, and inject them into ourselves? Do you think you get that approved? No way, right? But vaccination, we're quite happy with, right? So I think the same thing will happen with transgenics in the long run. For the moment, we're stuck with it. Well, that's enough BS. Thank you for listening.